AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires. Your journey, our passion.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 316 for January 22nd of 2016. Chevy Bolt, the EV for the rest of us. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific or 20 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. We're back in the saddle here. We're finally doing After Hours again. Man.
In the studio, no less.
I know. That's good. Although we should let everybody know, next week we will not be in the studio. There will be a show, but we're going to be out on the West Coast with the Hyundai Elantra. Right. That ought to be fun.
Mm-hmm. So just on the move all the time.
And we should let everybody know, joining us for today's show, too, is Mike Martinez from the Detroit News. And, Mike, it's great having you on board as well.
Thanks for having me. First time.
Cool. Good. You'll enjoy it. You'll see. You'll have a lot of fun here. Or you better have a lot of fun. Yeah. If not, it's your own damn fault.
That's right.
But our special guest for today's show is Steve Majoros. He is the Chevrolet Marketing Manager. And, Steve, cool to have you here.
Well, it's my first time as well, and I appreciate you having me along.
So you guys have had a busy 2 weeks to the kickoff of the year with the launch of the Chevy Bolt. Bolt with a B as in boy.
Bolt EV, correct. We like to say no rest for the weary at Chevrolet. We were very fortunate. It was actually a year ago around this time at the North American International Auto Show that we revealed the Bolt EV concept. And then as the year went on, we moved from concept to production intent. And then had a little bit of what I call the Texas two-step reveal over the last couple of weeks. First, we were at the Consumer Electronics Show, where Mary Barra had our keynote speech and formally debuted the production version of the Bolt EV. And really, we used CES as a platform to talk more about, I guess I would say, more the technology aspects of the vehicle. And then we followed it up, you know, just a few days later at the North American International Auto Show, where we kind of continued the reveal, but really focused more of the energy and messaging and attention there to the specifications of the vehicle. A lot of interest behind battery and capacity and charging and what have you. So a lot of information that we cascaded over the last couple of weeks with Bolt EV and I guess a broader Chevrolet and GM story as well.
So CES, technology, Detroit show, vehicle.
Pretty much. Yeah, you can kind of categorize it that way. So at CES, we talked a lot about infotainment technologies, you know, the things that we've been talking about at Chevrolet and at General Motors about 4G and Apple CarPlay, Android Auto, but we really expanded the story to things that we were bringing, you know, for the first time to a vehicle like Bolt EV. So little technologies like our rear view camera mirror, right, which is a really slick little feature that replaces a traditional mirror with actually a camera. You can still use the traditional mirror function.
Why keep both? Because I thought that was a little odd, that you have a mirror or you flick the switch and now it's a video screen.
In talking to customers and as you think about it, what it allows you to do is a lot of times you have to see what's going on in the back seat. You've got to move your mirror. You have to do things. So many people will now use this mirror. Well, they'll twist it or cock it to where they've got the view of what they want. If they want to look at kids or passengers in the back seat, so they can flip to that function, but they go to the traditional mirror, and you're not restricted to the physical proximity or the angle at which the mirror is located. So, you know, it gives you an 80-degree view behind the car. It gets rid of passengers, pillars, cargo, things like that, our surround vision cameras, obviously our low-energy Bluetooth. I'm sure we'll talk about that when we talk probably about autonomous or car sharing. And so lots of technologies in that space. And then, and as you mentioned, the Detroit Auto Show was much more about vehicle specifications and the things that really make Bolt EV such a phenomenal car.
And I think for people who don't know, I mean, you guys have basically completely leapfrogged virtually every EV manufacturer out there by offering a range of on the order of 200 miles when most of your competitors are down at 100 or less.
Correct. You know, we like to say that Chevrolet has cracked the code that has befuddled a lot of other manufacturers and candidly frustrated customers. And if you think about EV adoption and what's really one of the big barriers, today you can get great range. I mean, Tesla's a great company, produces a great vehicle. You're going to spend $100K or more or what have you, right? you can get a vehicle that has lower range, you know, or lower cost, but you're going to sacrifice range. So a Nissan Leaf is 84, and you know they've got some plans to get a little bit more, but that's about the top end of what a pure EV has got. So we've got a vehicle here that really solves both of those problems. And when you talk to customers and you ask them, what is that sweet spot range that kind of gets you over that adoption into EV? You're always going to have early adopters. I don't care what segment it is and what have you. But for really mass adoption of a vehicle like this, you've got to solve for both of those. And I think we're also solving it in a way that it's a configuration people are looking for. I mean, we all know being in this business, the propensity and the migration towards more crossovers, more multifunction type vehicles, and to provide a vehicle like this that isn't just a roller skate, you know. I mean, this vehicle has cargo capacity, safety features, technology features. It's a blast to drive. I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about, you know, 0 to 60 in under 7 seconds, and it's
which is a good number too, by the way. Yeah, I've right. driven the car, but
yeah, you know, so there's things like that just say from an overall package standpoint, you know, customers today expect a lot from their vehicle, right? It's years ago, if you were in the mid car segment, it's like, okay, well, it got me to point A to point B. That's kind of what I need. Well, today it's got to be a lot more than that, and so people are holding that same sort of set of expectations with an electric vehicle. And I think part of it is, if you think about our phones and our tablets and our televisions at home, 5-6 years ago, you go to retailer A or B and you buy a 50-inch TV, it's going to be whatever, $2,500, right? You know, you go to that same retailer today, I mean, the pace of change, especially in kind of electronics and technology, is that everything gets better and faster, faster processing, better features, and cheaper, right? And it almost feels that electric vehicles have this paradigm attached to them that is somewhat automotive and somewhat more like it's a piece of technology. And mm-hmm. so when you can solve that, I think that consumers realize that.
Right. And we should also mention that, you know, you're talking about $30,000 after
federal tax credit.
Now, are you talking $29,999.99?
We're not formally, you know, releasing pricing, but I will say we have a very good sense of where the market transacts. We have a good sense of where we need to be. And to your point, you know, that's after federal tax credits. But in many instances, there's a growing number of either state-level incentives, utility-based incentives. And it might be cash. It might be a credit. It might be a credit towards a charging installation. So there are a number of things, I think, that will help the transactional part of EV adoption. And I think that Bolt EV is going to be well-positioned to take advantage of that.
Why is Bolt a Chevy and not, say, a Cadillac?
Well, I think part of it is the proposition of a vehicle that delivers the range and cost equation. I mean, Chevrolet is a number of things to a number of people. But first and foremost, we're a brand about design, performance, and technology, but always delivered with a fundamental value proposition. And we talk a lot about the democratization of technology. And so when you look at more mass EV adoption, and when you look at customers who are going to enter the space, again, we're riding up the curve of early adopters to more an early majority, and that's really where I think that Chevrolet can play very well. And if you think about, I was talking to someone yesterday, and I posed the question to them. I said, what manufacturer has sold more plug-in electric vehicles than anyone else in the market? And they were kind of scratching their head, and they threw a few guesses out. And I said, it's Chevrolet. We have today the Volt, and we have the Spark EV. And, you know, so we have a lot of credibility in this space. And so we're very fortunate that Volt, and we surely expect that Bolt EV will do the same, will continue to bring new people to the Chevrolet franchise. And so, you know, a lot of these technologies, sometimes they start on higher-end models, and they trickle down, and sometimes they start in a place like this. But I think Chevrolet has a lot of credibility in this space. We have a lot of things when it comes to dealers and certification and training and infrastructure, because that's another EV adoption, you know, kind of question mark with people is, mm-hmm. well, where do I charge and how do I get it serviced and will I get the right experience? And so we're doing a number of things from a Chevrolet standpoint to make sure that the totality of the experience beyond the vehicle itself is right for the customer. And I think Chevrolet is well poised in those areas to work that way as well.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Mike.
Oh, yeah, sure. Stephen, just kind of curious, you mentioned bringing new people into the brand. Who is the demographic for the Bolt? I mean, is it you know, the young millennial who wants to save the polar bears, or is it more maybe higher income family type folks?
Well, what we see from Volt today is we're clearly getting what we would say is maybe a more desirable demographic portfolio. So we see people with higher incomes. We see more male. We see, you know, higher education levels, and that's kind of to be expected. But with Bolt TV, there's a, you know, a romantic notion that these are, you know, tree huggers. I'm going to use a bad term. But, you know, this real, it's like, it doesn't matter what it is. It's about green. And we kind of slant that a bit, and we're calling them green collars, not from a standpoint of green as save the earth. That's certainly part of this. But these people are very savvy. They're very savvy when it comes to the assessment of what meets their needs, whether it is financially, whether it's, does this fit my vehicle portfolio needs? So I think what we're going to see is a little bit less of a cookie cutter or a tightly defined demographic portfolio. We're going to see people that are more urban, clearly, than more rural, because the vehicle is a, you know, it's a B-size exterior with a D-category interior. So it's really, it solves a very nice packaging, you know, equation. It's great for city driving. It's great for, you know, those sorts of things. We're going to see people who, though, that do their homework, that I think finally look at this and say, yeah, this can work for me, because, you know, we take a page out of the recycling industry. They do a phenomenal job making it easy for all of us, right? I mean, the green bin's there, and I'm doing my part, but 15 years ago, how many of us were, you know, saving oil and going to the depot 30 miles away? And probably not a lot of us. But as industry, whether it's automotive, infrastructure, government, make things easier and better for people, people, they look at it and they say, this is finally going to work for me. So I think we're going to get the same sort of people that have a smart approach to what meets their transportation and mobility needs, and they put it in the context of economics, of vehicle transportation, and other factors, and I think they'll come and they'll realize this is the right vehicle for them. You know, what you see in a lot of electric vehicles today is a lot of, I'll call them Monday through Friday cars. This is my A, point A, and A to B, B to A, and I better charge at work, and I better charge at home. But on the weekends, we need something a little bit bigger, right? So a lot of people that have pure electric vehicles have a crossover, or they have something else, because on the weekends, they either have more cargo to carry, more people to move around. They don't want to be stuck wondering, well, if we're going to the beach or we're going to Ann Arbor and we might want to take a side trip and do something else, I don't want to feel like I'm inhibited from living the life I want to live.
Like you'll never get
home. Right. Am I going to be able to get home? So there's things like that I think are part of people's kind of mental makeup as they process these decisions.
We've got a question here from one of our viewers, Anton Waldman. Of course, you knew Anton was going to send something in. He really loves following the EV business. Mm-hmm. He points out that Tesla announces its cars and opens it up for reservations. He says they're saying that Tesla is going to open up reservations for its Model 3 this coming March, mm-hmm. just a couple of months away from now.
And this is the cheap one. This is not the
right.
Model S.
No, this is the Model 3 that's going to be head-to-head with the Bolt. He's saying Tesla might be able to get as many 200,000 reservations because, you know, of the new lower price with the Model 3. What are you going to do? I mean, even though you're talking about growing the market and this is going to get people over the hump because of its 200-mile range, 200,000 could suck all the air out of the room. Would Chevrolet consider offering reservations for the Bolt?
Well, we're looking at the manner in which we're going to distribute these cars. We have a lot of interest from people today.
But this is coming in March.
Well, you know, there's a big difference between reserving a car and physically delivering a car, right? So, I mean, I could open up a reservation system and I could get lots of names, but the reality is, can I deliver the car? We're going to deliver this car. We're going to deliver this car this year. And, you know, do I need a big inherent order-taking mechanism today? I've got, in reality, 3,300 of them with 3,300 Chevrolet dealers, right? So, I mean, in many instances with our 2016 Volt, there were a lot of people that were reserving Volts, but they're working with their local Chevrolet dealer. And then we work with order demand from a dealer standpoint, and we work about prioritizing orders and where the distribution should be. You know, part of the trick with a reservation system, with if I'm going to distribute this car across the country, which we certainly plan to do once we have sufficient inventory and what have you, is where's the best place to put it? Who's first? Why? You know, there's a lot of questions that go into that. I don't think that we're going to have any shortage of demand. We're going to work right now, starting with our dealer partners, to make sure that they've got people and they've got customers, and we'll make sure that we fulfill those accordingly. But we're not against it. We're just not announcing anything right now about the manner and way in which we'll distribute the first allotment of cars.
Steve, when I was driving over here today, I saw gasoline for $1.59 a gallon.
Yeah, it's great.
That's great for part of your business. How great is that for Volt?
Well,
or Bolt, excuse me.
You know, when you talk to electric intenders and owners, there is a greater sense of vehicle type or fuel type than there is fuel price. I mean, if the economics of gas go from, you know, $2.50 to $1.79, you know, for a vehicle like a Volt, it is now just, well, for the very few times I fill up, it just costs me even less. For a Bolt EV, there's still the greater economics of, does this fit with what I'm looking for? And, you know, gas price, sure, is there going to be a little of impact? There's the psychology, but the reality is gas prices today are not going to be what gas prices are in the future. I think that it's a statement that Chevrolet and a commitment GM is making to providing, you know, alternative propulsion solutions. And by the early demand that we've been getting from people and the early signals we're getting from dealers and customers is, I don't think that's going to be much of an inhibitor. As a matter of fact, if you look at Volt in December of 2015, it was the best sales month for Volt ever.
Right.
And that was at a time when gas was...
Is that the new one or the old one?
That was a combination, a little bit of both. But, Rianis, we were down to probably about maybe 500 in dealer inventory of the generation one of the Volt. So it was the majority, 85, 90% was the next generation, the 2016.
But for the year, Volt was down 18% compared to 2014. Sure. So, I mean... And that's a really good car. I mean, it's and the new one is better than, you know, by an order of magnitude, I think.
No doubt.
And, you know, so the question becomes, okay, if somebody goes into a Chevy dealer and there's the Bolt and there's the Volt, how do you think they're going to make a decision about which way
to go? Well, I think it's going to be what's right for them. I mean, some people may say, you know what, I can get in this electric game and I'm all for it, and I'm going to take the plunge and go in the deep end. We may get people who, I mean, there's a notion that Bolt EV buyers are going to be people who are graduating and working their way up, right? Okay, well, maybe I had a hybrid and maybe I got my first plug-in and okay, I've learned my way around this. I've got a 240 charge. So they mature into the process. There are those, though, that are like, you know what, I don't have one, but I've seen my friend, my neighbor, my coworker, now at my place of employment, there are, I'm making this up, you know, 5-10 chargers there. It just becomes a little more in the consciousness of could this work for me? Could I live this way? So I think we're going to get people who graduate their way up. There are people that will say, that's right for me because I've experienced this and I can graduate into it. There are those that say, you know what? I mean, the average person commutes 40 miles per day. So if you're commuting 40 miles per day, either of these two alternatives are great for you. But if you, maybe you don't have access, or maybe you say, you know what? I'm not going to go to the expense or time or whatever, or I live in a place where I don't have access to install my own 240 charger. I rent, I don't have a garage, et cetera. Well, you know what? But I can charge at public charging or workplace charging. So I can get what I need during the day, but I may not need to charge 2 or 3 days or for a month, and I can use gasoline to propel my vehicle. Whereas someone with a Bolt EV may say, I'm in the game, I've got the infrastructure, I can make it work, and then it'll come down to economics, usage, and then they'll figure it out.
Todd wrote in to say he's a EV driver. He's been driving EVs for 6 years. He's super excited about the Bolt, but he wants to know why there's no center headrest for the rear seat passengers. He says a simple, lightweight push-up design would suffice. Whiplash is no fun.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll bring that one back.
Okay.
No, okay.
Steve, you touched on this a moment ago, but still, overall, it seems like EVs have not caught on as well as most would hope. Does that change how you market this car? Do you need any sort of alternative marketing options compared to other Chevy or GM vehicles?
Yeah. You know, at Chevrolet, we like to say that our product portfolio can be, you know, it's kind of the blessing and the curse. You know, I have the great fortune to work with my team on 15 different cars, crossovers, electric and performance vehicles. That doesn't include trucks. So we have a big, wide portfolio to support. And whether it's Chevrolet or other manufacturers, 70 to 75% of industry volume is in five segments. So that's compact SUV, mid SUV. So for us, Equinox and Traverse, compact and mid car, for us, Cruise and Malibu, and full size pickup. So those are the big dogs that drive a lot of what we do. But in this space, you know, there is such a notion of, I call it eyeball to eyeball selling. I mean, there is just, I'd rather talk to five people who are enthusiasts, who understand the space, the kind of people who are writing in today, who live it every day. And you know, because if I can get them believing, advocating, debating with us, then I think that they're going to do a great job along with what we're doing to help get the word out. Let's be honest, we're never going to have Volt or Bolt EV have the order of magnitude that a Silverado or F-150 have as far as broad-based advertising and marketing. But if you ask EV owners, and not, because people are always like, how come you're not on TV? And I'm always like, well, what was the last TV show you watched last night? If I was to talk to you about two telecom advertisers, one of them uses a gal with a blue shirt and a quirky setting, and one uses this. Which one's Verizon and which one's AT&T? You know, and there's just things like that that are just the reality of marketing today with such an explosive growth in social and experiential and digital and content. And really, the EV story is something that is partially what manufacturers are doing, but there's a greater infrastructure that's helping get the word out there. And so those are the sorts of things that we're doing. But we are today advertising in traditional advertising channels, the Volt. We have a lot of spot TV in a lot of key markets. We have print. We have digital. We've got relationships with broader, more thought leadership type media. We're doing out of home. We sponsor charging stations. So we are doing things to help kind of kickstart and ignite the conversation.
But, you know, Mike's got a good point here, because all automakers, not just General Motors, have heretofore marketed their EVs as save the planet kind of approach. They've marketed to environmentally conscious people. When I drive EVs, what I love about them is they're so quiet, they're vibration-free, you have the instant torque available. Right. You're talking about 0 to 60 in less than 7 seconds. And, you know, in most enthusiast books, anything under 8 seconds is acceptable. Right. So under 7 is even better. When are people going to market the fact that these things are a blast to drive?
Well, and that's going to be a part of what we're going to talk about. Because, again, as I talk about the maturation and set of expectations, you know, we were talking just as much at CES and NAES about, you know, not just the battery chemistry, but the design of the battery. A completely flat load floor gives you near 50-50 weight distribution, wheels that are pushed out to the corners, a tremendous handling product. Because I think people need to know that, okay, this thing isn't a dog. It's got safety technologies. It's got great, phenomenal design. And so there's a broader picture at play here. We were just left a meeting here today talking about how do we make sure that the totality of the story is told, and the driving experience is certainly part of that. You know, so regen on demand, low mode, one pedal driving with this car. I mean, those are things that to some people, they scratch their head and go, I don't even know what one pedal driving is. Well, what that means is a combination of low gear, regen. You don't even have to touch the brake because that's a more efficient way to drive because it's returning uncaptured energy.
Especially in stop-and-go traffic.
Exactly. So if this is a more urban vehicle, but you know,
for those at home, you do have two pedals just to...
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
You know, but those are the sorts of things that, you know, I could take a 30-second TV spot and try to explain that, or I can do a ride-a-drive event with 100 people, let them drive it. You know, you had mentioned that you drove the car and other people had the ability to do so at CES. And you're sold, right? And
so if
you can get people to get behind the wheel and to put it in their own terms and their own words, I think it becomes much more powerful. And I think it's a way that, you know, we're clearly going to, you know, move away from this is, you know, a save the planet, you know, kind of a vehicle to this is just a great, not just a great electric vehicle, it's just flat out a great vehicle.
Yeah, I mean, I think that some people, I mean, with all due respect to the Spark EV team, which did a phenomenal job, I mean, but that's not a realistic car. I mean, it's a small, right? Here you have a real car that people can do real things with and go real distances and go to Costco and load it up with stuff and they're fine. And so, I mean, that is also changing the paradigm in certain ways.
Yeah, I mean, even little things like when we were, even the way we photograph the vehicle, even the way we shoot it, the way we talk about it, we have to celebrate the fact that this thing can swallow a lot of cargo. It can carry five people. The architecture of the car, you sit in this car, the headroom is phenomenal.
The knee room and the rear seat is phenomenal.
Thinner seat technology, asymmetrical seats that just minimize weight but add interior storage space, a completely flat load floor. So when you talk about things like car sharing and just overall usage of the vehicle, it is easy, it's convenient, it's cavernous, and so those are either indirect or more direct or overt stories we need to tell, either through people experiencing the car, what we talk about, how we photograph it, and how we show it. I mean, those are all important signals that we need to send.
Mm-hmm. Alan Carnut writes in to say the various Bolt websites say that with a fast charge option, I guess that's a level 3 charger, you can get 90 miles of range in 30 minutes. But then you got to find a fast charger all around. That's one of Tesla's advantages, is they're building out a network across the country. How does GM or Chevrolet compete with that?
Well, we're working through, there was a meeting today actually with ChargePoint, about infrastructure development. True, you can get, 30 minutes, 90 miles. The proliferation and the cost of fast charging is going to continue to go down. Where those are, who's in charge of funding them and building them. With 240, you can still get, if you were to drain the battery completely, 9 hours will get you back to, full charge. And if you're, it's about 25 miles, you'll get with about an hour of charging, with 240. So it's one of the fundamental issues that we face, right, is, okay, a little bit of field of dreams. If you build it, they will come. Well, so if fast charge options get built, then there'll be more and more adoption. The role that General Motors, other OEMs play, along with utilities, along with independent companies. These are all things that our public policy and other teams are working on to make sure that the infrastructure is there. These are issues that will face not just EV adoption, but as fuel cell and other things come in. It's okay. What's the source of the propulsion, and how do we make it readily available for people?
Mm-hmm. I was thinking when you were mentioning the portfolio that you guys have. Malibu is coming out with a good hybrid here fairly shortly. So, you've got quite a range of different alternative propulsion systems in your showroom.
We're very proud of what the commitment, investment, and expertise that the General Motors team has assembled at Chevrolet. I mean, Pam Fletcher, Andrew Farah from the design team. These people are phenomenal. And the great thing about it is there's such continuity from the very first development of Volt Gen 1 to the people that are doing Volt 2 to contributing to Malibu Hybrid to Spark EV. And so you've got an awful lot of transferred learnings there. You've got an awful lot of expertise. And, Chevy didn't just wake up and say, hey, we got to get in this electric vehicle game here, right? I mean, we've been there for a little bit. And it does enable us to do things like to bring forward. I mean, we are extremely proud of the all-new 2016 Malibu, and the hybrid variant is just going to be another great addition to that. That is enabled by all the investment and what we've done with Volt. And so, a car like that delivers 48 city, 47 combined, 45 highway. I mean, these are staggering numbers that are not, we're 1 mile per gallon away from another competitor. I mean, we're beating competitors by 5, 6, 7, 8 mpg, depending on mm-hmm. the city, highway, what have you.
Hey, we've got a phone call coming in, and then we're going to have to wrap up the segment. But, Carmen, let's bring in that phoner.
Hey, guys, great show. Quick question. GM dealers, are they going to have chargers for people to get a quick charge, like a Tesla supercharger, but are at the GM dealership, the Chevy dealership across the country? That would make people feel pretty comfortable. Love the Bolt. The performance is amazing. Looks fabulous. But got to tell you, I think the Tesla 3 and Tesla Y CUV are going to be sexier looking. And that's the dichotomy of the success for electrics. Is yes, we want them really fast and quick and efficient, But some of us want, you know, really CUV, Porsche Macan-like styling, or it is cool, by the way, that the Fiesta ST isn't as quick as your Chevy Bolt. Didn't go on deaf ears. Very cool. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks. And I'm pretty sure that's Jonathan. I think I recognize that voice.
I'll touch on a couple things. First and foremost, you know, we have very specific agreements with our dealers that are certified to sell and service electric vehicles. And part of that is they have to have 240-level chargers. We're talking right now about infrastructure and, you know, DC fast charge, whether it be at our dealership. I mean, it's a big investment. And, you know, it's a lot to go to a dealer and say, I mean, imagine what we ask our dealers to.
I don't want to go to the dealer to charge my car anyway.
I mean, part of it, too, is where's the right place to have them, right? I mean, if you're the
ideally... If they're right by the freeway, that might be.
If you're the ideally situated dealer, that's great. If you're not the ideally situated dealer, then it's kind of like, well, is that the place where I want to go or I need to go? Is that convenient for me? I mean, it's much more about whether it's on freeways, whether it's in more traditional urban centers around a high concentration of office and parking. And so there's things like that. The second item, as far as styling, I mean, we're very proud of what we've come for with Bolt EV. And when you think about things like the largest touchscreen we've put in a car, 10.2 inches, all the reconfigurability, widget kind of based look, interior lighting, we are not taking design lightly. And I think that we've got a home run product in our hands here. Mm-hmm.
It's going to be real exciting to see how this develops. And, Steve, I want to thank you for coming in and talking all about it. This is not going to be the end of our Volt discussions. We're going to have, you know, I want a car in the studio next time.
Well, anytime. I had a great time being here. I appreciate it, and I'd be happy to come back anytime.
Great. Cool. Steve Majors, thanks so much for coming on Autoline After Hours. Okay. We're going to take a quick break right now. We're going to give a shout-out to our friends at Bridgestone, but we're going to be back, and we got a lot more of other things to talk about. Had a chance to drive that Chevy Bolt yet?
No. I was at CES, so I got to take it around the parking lot there.
Yeah.
I wish we could have taken it out on the strip. That would have been more fun.
Well, that would have been a whole lot better. Mm-hmm. But, you know, those are probably million-dollar prototypes anyway.
Sure.
So, or maybe even, who knows, more than a $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, they let me take, because I was with Josh Tavel, and you know, we did a lap, and I said, can I do another? Yeah. Did that. Can I do another? Yeah. Can I do another? Yeah. So I was impressed. I think it's a terrific car. And, this was a Gymkhana-like handling course that they had set up. I thought it handled really well what Steve was talking about, putting the batteries in the floor, brings the center of gravity down, pushing the wheels out. The interior room truly is spectacular.
And you see that investment with Lyft and now with the Maven announcement they made today and with the rideshare, and it's perfect for that sort of thing. Plenty of space, nice and easy, good technology, too. Mm-hmm. The 10.2-inch touchscreen, I think, up front.
Yeah. Okay, it's that time of the show. Dr. Data, have you a number?
Okay, we have a number here. So, Carmen, could you bring up the first slide, please? Okay, so Oxford Street in London.
And well, we should say it says 4 days on Oxford Street, January 1 through 4, 2016.
Okay, so Oxford Street, heart of London, major shopping district. Okay, very, very exciting place, lots of people there. So it just so happens that in these 4 days on Oxford Street, what did we get? Next slide, please. We got more than 200 micrograms of nitrogen dioxide per cubic meter. Now, why is that important?
I think I know where you're going, because this is maybe related to diesels.
It is related to diesels, but what is very remarkable is that, so we saw that number. Well, the European Union has a limit of only 18 hours per year that you can exceed that number, and they did it in 4 days. Mm. So they've done an entire, so here's the, you know, it was in the context of, we just were talking about an electric vehicle, you know, the Bolt, and you know, we're all saying, well, gee whiz, you know, gas is so cheap now that why do we need alternative powertrains, right? You know, we need to worry about this anymore. But you look at what's going on around the planet in terms of things that are, you know, associated with...
Why doesn't London just clean up its diesels?
Well, I mean, there is that problem for sure. And, you know, but the thing of it is that, you know, as you well know, the popularity of diesel trucks and buses and cars and whatnot. Now, the mayor of London, very flamboyant Boris Johnson, is talking about a scrappage scheme to get rid of diesels. But, I mean, so Naples, at the beginning of the year, 6-day vehicle ban.
Naples, Italy.
Naples, Italy.
Not Florida.
Not Florida. Not yet. Then we had a situation in Rome where they're basically restricting car use because of smog. You know, we've seen the things in Beijing. Well,
but they are presumably not limiting EVs.
No, because there'd be no pollution, right?
And well, so no pollution.
Well, and even in London, I mean, the restrictions are saying that if you have an alternative powertrain. So, you know, the point I'm making is the fact that, you know, there's some discussion that when CARB has the 2017 review of the 2025 45.5 miles per gallon.
That 54.5.
Excuse me. That, you know, they may dial that back some, but we fail to take into account the emissions part of this whole thing that the rest of the world really is getting knocked on its ass by.
That's right. But you know what? I can tell you from having visited London over the years, it's way cleaner today than it was 10 or 20 years ago.
And it was probably cleaner than when Charles Dickens lived there, too. But,
That's right. Well, interesting number. Interesting number.
Good stuff.
So would you want to breathe that?
I would not.
No, none of us want to breathe that. Hey, so this has been a crazy first 2 weeks to the year, the prior 2 weeks to this. Mike, you were at CES. Gary, you were at a little bit of CES, right? But you're both at the Detroit Auto Show. What's your guys' impression? Because my impression is CES stole a lot of thunder away from the Detroit show.
It really did. And I'm not sure, maybe it was just a product cycle, right? Last year you had the GT that wowed everybody. You had, you know, the at least as far as Ford goes, the Continental Concept wowed everybody. This year, the Acura NSX. This year, you know, you have a couple concepts there, but just not a lot of wow factor. There's more mainstream stuff, right? The minivan was the star of the show. I don't know, how exciting that could be. But, yeah, there was a lot of chatter from folks in Vegas, then in Detroit, too. Maybe you want to space these two shows out. I don't know how you do that. I don't know who takes, you know, that first step, but maybe you want to give some time.
All right, I'm going to be against both of you guys because you both believe that CES is taking the cake here. Okay, so what did CES basically have? They had the Bolt, right?
Faraday Future.
Well,
I know, which is a joke in my book. But
right, there was probably probably something in the basement of Cobo Hall we didn't even see that was like as exciting or as relevant as that.
Yeah, because I don't want to diss what the Faraday Future guys are doing car design wise. I think it's pretty cool, but I think their business plan is, you know, and it's not going to happen.
Right, and so for those that aren't familiar with this is they showed a supercar with, you know, phenomenal performance numbers, and they showed
1,000 horsepower.
You know, and it was a skateboard design, which came from where? Oh, that's right, General Motors, from some years ago. But, you know, so you had that. I mean, you know, you had NVIDIA showing a new chip that they can use, right? I mean, it's just...
Well, you had the Buddy from Volkswagen, right?
Yeah.
New microbus.
So yes, and so that was an alternative powertrain.
The BMW i8 Roadster, which they did not even bring to Detroit, by the way. And Volkswagen did not bring the Buddy to Detroit. And you had Faraday Future there. You had Chevrolet with Mary Barra unveiling the Bolt. And that's why I'm saying
Mary Barra came to the Detroit show.
She did, but a week later, everybody had written their stories by that point about the Bolt.
All right, so to your point, yes, we had the Pacifica, which I think is a profoundly significant vehicle.
Why so?
Well, I mean, because basically it occurs to me that if you're a ordinary person who's going into auto show, not a automotive journalist or car person, that you're going there and you're looking for something for your family. You're looking for something normal. You're looking for something that is going to take you to get the groceries and kids to soccer practice and so on and so forth. And here are here's Chrysler, the company that basically
invented
the minivan, saying, okay, we're going to take a whole fresh new look at this, and we're going to not even call it the Town and Country anymore, despite the fact that Town and Country had a legendary name. We'll call it the Pacifica, which I'm a little about, since the Pacifica that was out in the market for
five years.
Was it 5 years?
5 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, you know, I thought that was a pretty significant vehicle. We had
just a point, because I know there's going to be a lot of people going, Chrysler didn't invent the minivan. You know, the Volkswagen bus was way before that. And there's going to be other old timers are going to say, you know, the Stout Scarab in the 30s was really the invention. But you're right. They created the minivan segment. Chrysler did.
And then it also is worth noting that they have the plug-in hybrid version of the Pacifica,
which does not say plug-in on it anywhere, and in their presentation never said the word plug-in. And to your point, I mean, Chrysler understands the minivan customer, I think, better than anybody in the business. There's a reason they're not calling this a plug-in. They're only calling it a hybrid, and I think it's because when they clinic this stuff, their customers probably went, what? What do you mean you got to plug this damn thing in? So they're not calling it a plug-in.
Mm-hmm. But so, you know, the first to market with that. So, I mean, I would say that is easily far more important than the Bud E from Volkswagen, which we'll never see, by the way.
You're probably right.
And, you know, so Detroit had that. We saw the Ridgeline, the Honda Ridgeline.
Yeah, no, that's a significant car, too.
Okay.
And truck.
Well, there's another vehicle that, you know, people have poo-pooed over the years.
I'm not trying to say that CES is killing Detroit. All I'm saying is having those shows back-to-back, 1 week after the other, is hurting the Detroit show. It's not killing it. It's hurting
it.
And I think this is a good time. You know, Mike, you're saying, why don't we put some space between the shows? Let's make that space about 4 months, and let's get the Detroit show in Michigan when the weather is fantastic.
Right. See, I'd say snow is going to kill that show before CES kills that show.
And 10 degrees, you know, Monday morning to go up, you know, go downtown. I got up in the morning. It's 10 degrees outside.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you drive on icy roads all the way down there. There's other idiots that don't know how to deal with it. So the traffic's way backed up. You get downtown. There's no place to park. Finally, you find a place. You tromp through the snow. You get into Cobo. My shoes are all wet and covered in salt, and the line for the coat check goes to next Thursday. And I tell you, it just sucks all the energy out of the show.
So how do you really feel about it?
Well, I'll tell you what.
Move it to June.
That'd be great.
Or something.
It may not be killing the show, though, but it's definitely killing the journalists who have to cover them back to back. I mean, I fly back in, I think, Thursday night. You're already pre-writing stuff, getting stuff ready for the Detroit show, which starts basically Sunday now.
Yeah.
So I'll take just a week. You know, you want 4 months, I'll take a week.
People want to hear us whining about that.
They
want to know about the cars.
They get everything for free, and they're still not happy.
All right, so I'm saying Pacifica, very significant car. What did you see at the auto show?
No, I would agree with you. I I'll tell you why, because I brought my wife down during the charity preview and showed her the Chrysler Pacifica. Now, we've had 3 minivans in our time, and when the kids grew up, and my wife said, that's it, no more minivans for me, I'm sick of them. I love the Town and Country that we had. I still think it's one of the best vehicles I've ever owned. But when she saw that new Pacifica, she went, whoa, I kind of like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a winning, you know, good housekeeping stamp of approval from what Chrysler's done. That here's this woman who said, I don't want another minivan in my life going, hey, I kind of like the way that thing looks. Not that she's going to get one, but she liked the way that the thing looks. So I'm with you on that. I think it is a significant one. I would agree that the Honda Ridgeline was significant. Look, I like the Honda Acura Precision Concept. If this is indicative of where Acura styling is really going, hallelujah, it's about time. I thought the Mercedes E-Class was an important reveal at the show as well.
So, To the point of the Ridgeline, so here we have basically a car-based truck, right? And everybody used to say, Honda doesn't know what it's doing and it's crazy. You know, it occurred to me, and we've talked on the show, we've had Mike Swears from Toyota and Jeff Luke from GM, you know, both truck engineers, and we've talked about the Tacoma, and we've talked about the Colorado and the Canyon. And it seems to me that now is the time for something like the Ridgeline. Now this new one comes into this segment that there's now this mid-sized truck category that really has a lot of interest to it. And these guys are able to say, hey, now take a look at what we've done.
No, you're right. And, you know, this one looks like a normal pickup. You know, the original Ridgeline looked like it had some birth defect. It was all quirky and, you know, it didn't look good.
Didn't like those cell panels, huh?
No, they were stupid. And I liked the Ridgeline. I mean, it fit my lifestyle perfectly. But it was quirky looking. Not that that bothered me too much, but when it came out, it was really pricey for what it was. So we'll see. I don't know. What do you think, Mike?
No,
Ridgeline?
I think it could work because, like you said, this segment has expanded. These midsize trucks have done well. It's a completely different customer, right, than, you know, F-150 or Silverado maybe. So there's a place for it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, too, the pickup segment is so big, as, you know, Steve even talked about. It's so profitable.
Yeah.
You know, if you're a full-line or nearly full-line manufacturer like Honda is, you got to go for it. You got to. I mean, from a business standpoint, you're not doing your job if you don't go for it.
So what did you think of the production Continental?
I liked it. I mean, I don't think they changed too much from the concept, and they even tried to keep the cool, you know, little door handle. Mm-hmm. I think this is, you know, Lincoln's planting its flag in the ground. They're saying we're going to be about quiet luxury, and what exactly does that mean, right? Maybe, you know, going up against Cadillac, where it's more about performance and speed and power, Lincoln's a little more understated and more elegant, maybe. But you get, what was it, 400 horsepower, I think, something around. Mm-hmm. So it has the capability, but they're more, you know, quiet, nice and easy. I thought it was a very kind of classy kind of presentation. I think for at least a few years now, they've had this kind of live jazz band.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the models, kind of these elegant blue gowns and these like 1960s throwback hairstyles. The car itself, I like the new face of Lincoln. I like the grill. Jaguar-esque, though. The interior, though, that 30-way seat, I want to get that for the office.
Yeah.
you could take a nap in that thing pretty easy. Right. It's pretty nice.
So, I mean, and it's interesting. So you know, you're a comparatively young man. I mean, and I say that in a nice way.
Thank you.
And so, I mean, so when you look at, I mean, the Continental, I mean, even if you wouldn't buy, I mean, does it speak to you in some way that you would say, you know what, that's all right?
I don't know what it's going to do for them as far as getting a younger demographic. I think they got to rely on McConaughey for that.
Mm-hmm. But I think he's done.
Yeah. Well, I think he still has to go through the end of the year as far as the advertising goes. I think they got him to a 2-year deal. I'm not sure if it would appeal to a younger buyer, but it is. I think it's a beautiful car.
Mm-hmm. See, that's important. I like Lincoln's approach, not trying to outdo the Germans, which is what Cadillac's trying to do. They've watched Cadillac, you know, since 1999 go chase Mercedes, BMW, and Audi, and it really, the cars are terrific. But from a sales standpoint, they haven't moved the needle. From a perception standpoint, they've barely moved the needle outside of, you know, the enthusiast media. So I like what Lincoln's doing. I think it's a smart approach. I'm not knocked out by the styling of the Continental. I don't look at that and go, oh, be still my heart.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm kind of with you, Mike. That 30-way seat, I am knocked out by the interior. So what about you, Gary?
No, I really like the car a lot. I mean, I think that... For a buyer who is looking for a luxury car, and luxury connoting something that is not performance, luxury connoting something that is comfort and amenities.
What they call quiet luxury, and I like that term.
Although that reminds me of quiet tuning from Buick, and I just don't know that I would want to, you know, I think they want to equate themselves with Cadillac, not with Buick, and so that's a little bothersome. But, you know, I look at that and I think, you know, you know, as both of you guys have mentioned, that, you know, they're going into a spot where Cadillac and the others aren't, you know, basically saying, okay, you know, we're not going to have drag races at a stoplight with a CT6. I mean, we're just not going to do that. Mm-hmm. And Cadillac is going in that direction. And so, you know, what is luxury? Is luxury all about performance? I don't think so. And, you know, it begs the question. So, you know, as everybody knows, that the platform is not a rear drive platform in the Continental, and that's like anathema to,
sure,
you know, everyone. Oh, you can't possibly have an electric car without a rear drive platform. Does that matter anymore? Tesla doesn't have a rear drive platform.
No, they have all wheel drive.
And you can get the Continental as all wheel drive.
You know, I don't think it does matter if you do it right, but typically in a front-wheel drive car because all the power is going through the front wheels and the steering wheels connected to them. There are times where, depending on the vehicle, you can get a vibration through it. And definitely from a proportion standpoint, the classic dash-to-axle ratio. But there's some really interesting packaging going on with front-wheel drive right now where they're starting to get a more classical dash to axle proportion mm-hmm. that you typically would otherwise have gotten with a rear drive car. So, yeah, I mean, I think if you do it right, maybe it doesn't matter at all.
I do want to make one more point, though. I think this is an important car for the Lincoln brand, right? Because it's essentially designed for China almost as much as it's designed for
Great
here.
Point.
And they're opening, well, I think they're going to nearly double the amount of dealerships. They're hoping for around 60 or so by the end of this year over there. 11,000 sales on their first full year. So that rear seat, right, very roomy, a lot of chauffeuring going on over there. So that's, I think, even more so than how it sells here, should watch what happens over there.
And you make a great point because I've had Chinese experts tell me this, that in Asia, they really don't like aggressive, assertive styling. They prefer much softer, smoother approach to styling. And so when you contrast Lincoln versus Cadillac, to your point, I think Lincoln has got the right kind of styling for China.
Man, can you imagine, though, that if you're really banking on China, now it's going out with the Chinese economy and sales just collapsing left, right, and center. I mean, man, there's going to be a lot of blood on the streets there in terms of, you know, vehicle manufacturers, all of whom have been, you know, fighting to get a piece of that you know, ever-growing market. That's going to really be troublesome.
Hey, they're giving me the sign here that we've got another phone call. We've got a viewer calling in, and Carmen, let's bring him in.
Hey, guys. This was the best Detroit show in a long time. That Buick Avista coupe has got everybody going nuts. You know, I don't know if you guys are aware of it, but regular car guys are going gaga over the Buick coupe. I mean, you know, a lot of us wish it would have an LT1 V8. Instead of a twin turbocharged V6, but we'll take it either way. How long do you think it'll be before that thing comes out? If you take a guess, 6 months, a year, or two? Thanks in advance.
Yeah, I think you're dreaming.
I don't know. So I talked to Brian Nesbitt, who's now in charge of global design for Buick, and to the point of China. So he had most recently been in China, and he said, and this is his term, he said, when he went over there, it was the perception of Buick, in his estimation, was absolutely surreal. And he kept using the word surreal because Buick is perceived as being a vibrant, youthful brand, you know, not quiet.
Not what it is here.
Not quiet tuning.
Or what they're trying to change here.
Right. And so if you look at the production LaCrosse, which is a vast change, positive change, I think, from, you know, what they've had in the past. And you look at that car and you say, okay, what does Buick really need to establish itself?
Halo car.
And what would be better than
a Riviera?
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, look, this is not a new thought. You know, this has been talked about for years. And GM has said, boy, we're getting fantastic feedback, just like we heard. And look, the car is knockout good. I don't believe they're ever going to build it. Why? Number one, it's a coupe. Coupes sell in very small numbers. I don't know how coupes do in China. I'll bet they don't do very well at all. And so you see very few automakers offering coupes unless they can sell them on a global basis, because that's the only way you get the volume to justify the tooling. I don't think Buick's going to get the volume to justify the tooling. Maybe if you got a Cadillac version off of two or something. I'm sure there's some pretty sharp pencils being sharpened at General Motors right now trying to build a business case around it. My bet is when it comes down to pulling the trigger, they're just going to go, you know, guys, we just cannot make the return we need.
I don't know. I mean, they're launching a convertible, for God's sake. I mean,
who's that old Buick Cascada thing?
I mean, who's...
How old is that thing, by the way?
But I mean...
It's three or four years old, and we're just getting it?
But why? Okay, I mean, who buys convertibles?
Well, you know, again...
It'll be really good for the rental fleet down in Florida.
Well, you know, again, it's an Opel. So, again, coming back to my point of it being more of a global vehicle, and I think they're just trying to help Opel out by getting some more volume for it here. I'm not sure that this is really going to move the needle for Buick. I hope to be proven wrong. I would love to be proven wrong, but, you know, we all get gaga about wagons, convertibles, and coupes. We in the media do. And at the end of the day, they just don't sell.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they're going to bring it out, although I would say it was a very strong show for Buick, right? It's interesting. I know some of my colleagues at the news were talking about it's interesting to see the amount they're investing there in that brand where before, right? You thought it was just kept around for China, but they're doing some good things here in the U.S. there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we didn't even mention the Envision, sure, which is coming in from China, mm-hmm, to help Buick out here. And I think we'll see more of that happening, more Chinese vehicles coming this way as opposed to U.S.-made vehicles going there. We're
the Envision
slapped with a 25% import tax anyway.
And the Envision being a crossover, which is a category that you probably can't fail at?
Not these days.
Is it possible? I mean, it's crazy.
Put them out there and they'll sell.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're getting down to the end of the show here. What do you guys think of all this car sharing, ride sharing? A lot of this came out of both CES and the Detroit show. More talk of autonomy. And very interesting how we see cheering sections and others who are saying, nah, this is never going to happen.
I think it is. I think it's the future. And again, I have probably a different perspective, right? I'm a young millennial living in a downtown area where
I would Uber app on your phone.
I do. I use it all the time. And I would use, you know, this new Maven car sharing service. Although I think the one thing to note is how is a GM or a Ford or an automaker going to brand this any differently than, say, a Zipcar? And I was trying to think today, what would make me choose Maven over just buying a Zipcar? Or renting a Zipcar for an hour or a day or so. And I think it's going to, you know, it's going to have to be price, you know, they keep this price competitive. And I don't know, maybe there's that kind of feeling you get when you see that GM logo on it and know it's legit. Maybe, I don't know. But it'll be interesting to see how they play with the traditional players like Uber or Zipcar in that space.
Yeah, they're going to have to market like crazy.
Well, we've got to, you know, differentiate between, like, the Zipcar whereby you get a car,
sure,
you drive the car, and it's like a micro rental sort of a situation versus,
right,
an Uber where somebody's going to come and pick you up, and it's a alternative taxi situation. So
right,
so Maven is basically going to be the drive it yourself, you know, micro rental sort of thing. I thought it was interesting that they're launching it in Ann Arbor. And where's Zipcar have an operation? Oh, that's right, Ann Arbor. You know, big university town, you know, kids don't necessarily have places to park their cars. So why not
try parking in Ann Arbor?
Yeah, so why not use the service? But I think that it's indicative of the fact that, you know, and you know, you hear Mark Fields talking about how they've got to do more services. Maybe Jack Nasser was actually right back when he was talking about doing all kinds of ancillary services and shouldn't have been reviled as much as he was. But
yeah, except for the fact that it didn't work.
Well,
that's
neither here nor there. I think they're coming to an awareness that by and large, there will be many people in your generation and the generation to follow that are just going to say, can't afford to buy a car.
Well, look, going back to the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, Umtree came out and documented this, that the number of 18-year-olds through 39-year-olds who have a driver's license is dropping.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look, and the younger that cohort gets, the bigger the drop, and I mean statistically significant, huge drop-offs in those with driver's licenses.
Right. So that plays to the services, it doesn't play to the sharing of a car, because if you don't have a license.
Well, here's the key. I had a fascinating dinner with the guy in Europe who ran Hertz On Demand. Now, remember, Zipcar was so promising, Avis went out and bought Zipcar. So Hertz said, hey, you know, we got to do the same thing. So they offered Hertz On Demand. They've closed it down in both the United States and in Europe. Why? Because they can't make money on it. Why can Uber make so much money? Uber doesn't own any cars.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have this massive capital investment in all these cars parked all over the place. And so this guy said that's what it's all going to come down to now. Who can compete against Uber where you don't have to own the vehicle. Or he said there are a few places where it Hertz on demand did work, but it can only be in very high population density areas. And he said they had worked with some places like huge apartment complexes where they would have some cars. But he said the problem is if somebody would take the elevator down and go out into the garage and wanting to get a Hertz on demand car and there's no car there, they think, oh, okay, well, I'll jump on the bus. He said the second time they come down and there's no car, he says they never come back.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Uber's probably got this figured out better than Hertz did because they got the apps. And maybe GM with Maven can figure this all out where you get high utilization of these cars. But I thought that was an eye-opener for me that Hertz, I mean, if anybody can't figure out how to put butts in cars.
All right, but okay, isn't it possible that the Hertz model just doesn't lend itself? I mean, so historically Hertz has been the, you know, you go to the airport and you rent a car, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're O.J. Simpson, you run through the airport and then you rent your car. And so now it's a whole new, and I dare say, paradigm in terms of the way people are accessing mobility. And maybe that was the problem with those guys, because it just seems to me that because the, you know, so you've got, you know, General Motors giving a $500 million investing in Lyft, right? I mean, those guys aren't silly down in the Renaissance Center now. I'm sure that they're very, very conscientious of where they spend their money. And I think that they see going forward that unless they're in the game, they're going to find themselves looking in the window at some point saying, gee, I wish I had been at that table.
I think it's very much a toe in the water kind of thing. They have to try. And I was talking to Bill Ford at the auto show, and he said, this isn't just about tomorrow's headline. This, you know, getting into the mobility space and even autonomous. This is about getting in and trying, and in some cases, we're going to fail.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the business model doesn't work. Maybe they haven't realized what will work yet, but they got to try, they got to experiment. Some will succeed, some will fail, but you have to at least try, right? I mean, you look at Fiat Chrysler, where are they in all this?
Yeah, they're not. Now, Sergio made an interesting point. He said, look, suppliers are going to develop all this. I'm paraphrasing what he said. Suppliers are going to develop all this stuff, and then we'll just go get it when we need it because the market's not there yet. But I like what you're saying there, Mike, because I believe this is truly disruptive technology. When you see the way especially a GM and a Ford are plunging headfirst into this, I mean, $500 million, that's a huge investment, huge investment. So, yeah, this has been deep, heavy, argumentative, boardroom-level discussions before they went out and said, boom, we're getting involved here. Because they know if they don't get involved, to your point, Gary, they're going to be on the outside.
Okay, but here's a question. So BMW has Drive Now.
Mm-hmm.
Daimler has Car2Go.
Yep.
What do the Asian companies have?
Toyota's got a little bit of an experiment going, and to my knowledge is the only Asian. I take that back. Renault and Nissan are doing some little things, but they're playing around very much at the fringes. They don't take it seriously. In fact, Carlos Ghosn was at the show poo-pooing the whole idea of ride-sharing and car-sharing. Which I was astonished to hear him say that, especially on the heels of GM and Ford's announcements.
Right.
I don't think you can poo-poo this. It's here to stay, and it's going to change the way we all drive.
Okay, do you think, okay, here's the question. Does this decrease the number of vehicles sold on an annual basis because people are choosing to use the service rather than choosing to buy a vehicle?
Absolutely.
And is it going to be significant? Are you going to notice it?
I think if it does, I don't think the automakers will be hurt by it because they are playing in the mobility space anyway. And, you know, if demand goes down, you know, we'll probably see prices go up, right? Supply-demand kind of thing. So maybe they won't be as hurt financially as some might think.
No, this is why they're getting into it. I think, now this is not going to be tomorrow, this is not going to be 5 years, but you start looking out and you bet it's going to reduce car sales. It's going to reduce the number of vehicles that we need. I mean, the math is easy. The average car today sits parked for 22 hours a day. Now, imagine if you can flip that around and the car is used for 22 hours a day, servicing many different people and or households. You just don't need as many cars.
Mm-hmm.
You don't. And here's the other problem is it takes only a little bit of a drop to really have a huge impact on the industry, which is an industry now under massive pressure from the financial community to deliver much better margins and give more cash back to shareholders. And how are they doing it? They're trying to do it with scale. You know, common platforms, common parts, globalization, mergers and acquisitions. You start taking away even just a little bit of that scale, and they can't deliver the margins. And this is why they're looking at mobility services and going, holy moly, the mobility services market generates twice as much revenue as the entire automotive industry does. Let's go grab a piece of it.
They got nothing right now. So I tried to nail down, Mark Fields gave that stat, I think $4.3 trillion maybe.
He said the auto industry generates $2.3 trillion, a staggering number, but that mobility services is $5.4 trillion, more than twice as big as the automotive industry.
Okay, so the question becomes, though, is this going to be new money, or is this existing money that's just going into different pockets? Meaning, you know, it sort of strikes me as when I was reading about London, and there's another phenomenon that Uber just got, you know, the green light there, and because there's been some controversy there, as there are in many cities. And there was a statistic talking about how in the congestion zone in London that the number of cars for hire is like doubling because everybody wants to be in there, right? So the black cabs want to be there, the Uber X drivers want to be there, everybody wants to be there. And it's just like I began to think, well, you know, are there a doubling in the number of people who need to go from A to B? Or so the question becomes, will these Ubers just take the money away from Checker Cab, and will General Motors take some money away from Uber? You know what I mean? And so you're just moving the chips around.
There's a lot of movement of chips going around, no question about it. But what ride sharing a la Uber and ultimately autonomous cars do is open up mobility to greater segments of society. So now the very young who can't have a driver's license because they're not legally of age, and the very old who are infirm and really don't want to go out, especially at night or in bad weather, now you're starting to open it up. And anybody who's disabled, anybody who's got a substance abuse problem, you're opening up mobility for a lot more members of society. So in point of fact, we'll probably see fewer vehicles, but the total number of miles driven is going to increase.
Hmm. Good point.
So, hey, look, we should wrap this up. We're going to have to do a whole show on this because this is a great topic. And I'm just astonished at just in January of 2016 alone how this whole topic has just exploded. And not just people talking about it, but companies laying down real serious money.
Yeah, very serious money.
Sure. But Mike Martinez, thanks so much for coming on, man. It's been great having you on. Well, we'll definitely want you back again in the future.
Appreciate it. Thanks, guys.
Cool. And then, Gary, you and I are going to be out in Imperial Beach, California next week.
Talking Elantra.
Talking Hyundai Elantra. We're going to do the show out there. So I want to invite all of you to tune in then. And this has been a great show. So definitely tune in again next week.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There is all that and much more at autoline.tv.